Stuart Allen speaking from Wilson Street Chapel, London. And we're continuing our consideration of some of the difficult old words in our authorised version. So old and archaic some of them are that we just have nothing equivalent to them. And so I'm trying to get their modern equivalents so that we can understand the context in which they occur. The next word I want to consider, have you ever heard of a meat yard? I do not mean M-E-A-T, a place where meat is kept. M-E-T-E. It occurs in the Bible if you turn to Leviticus 19. Leviticus chapter 19. This is a chapter of miscellaneous commands, God's commands to his people. There's a warning in verse 31 against what we would call today spiritism, them that have familiar spirits, mediums. Verse 32, thou shalt rise up before the hoary head and honour the face of the old man and fear thy God, I am Jehovah. Then there's the attitude to a stranger coming in your midst. You see how God legislated for all sorts of circumstances that might take place. And then in verse 35, you shall do no unrighteousness in judgment in meat yard, in weight, or in measure. The context tells you it's something to do with weights or measures, but I think if I remind you of our old English translation of the Sermon on the Mount, with what measure ye meet, M-E-T-E, it shall be measured to you again. It's a measuring rod, and they had standard measuring rods in those days. So we've got to retranslate that. You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in measuring rod, in weight, or in measure. Now, as I pointed out before, some of these things have no doctrinal significance, but they would just make a difficulty if you read that context. Some of them have, of course, as I shall show you. The word to mock had quite a different meaning in the 17th century. It had none of the nasty meaning that it has today, to mock at a person. It meant to jest, or to play, or to joke. So that when you read in Genesis 19, Lot's warning concerning the destruction of Sodom, Genesis 19 and verse 14, and Lot went out and spake to his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But he seemed as one that mocked to his sons-in-law. Well, Lot wasn't mocking at anything. He thought maybe he was joking. He was one who was joking to his son-in-law. Oh my, what a joke. Wasn't it terrible? They thought he was joking, not mocking, jesting. Or, in 21st chapter of Genesis, Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael, all the problems that have come to Ishmael. We are suffering them today, aren't we? The problems of the Middle East with the Arab and the Jew. Go right back, this is where it started, Ishmael and Isaac. But we're told in verse 9, and Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had borne to Abraham, mocking. Now that gives you quite the wrong picture. This young child wasn't mocking anybody, he was playing. That's all it means. He wasn't taking the rise out of anybody, as we say. He was playing. He was probably playing with Isaac. And then she realized the promise that God had given, that it's through her seed, through Isaac, that the promised child, the Messiah, was coming. And therefore, there had to be this division. I know it sounds very hard, doesn't it? Where she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son. For the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. But God was overruling that. And don't forget that he hadn't left Ishmael. He'd made promises to Ishmael. You see for yourself. And so this is too strong in our English translation. He wasn't mocking at all. He was merely playing. Now another word that's changed. Naughtiness. The word naughty comes into the Bible. Well now, you know how it's used today. When a child is, we say, rather naughty. Well, we wouldn't say he was being wicked or doing something very wrong, just a little wrong, you see. It's sort of minimized, wrong minimized. But friends, in the 17th century, it was just the opposite. It was wickedness of the worst kind to be naughty. Don't you see? It comes from naught, nothing, worth nothing, worthless, absolutely worthless, it originally meant. Turn to James for a moment. The Epistle of James. Well, we get it used, and a rather extraordinary expression. You have probably read this verse, maybe you wonder what it meant. This is a command, James 1 and verse 21. Wherefore, lay apart all filthiness and superfluity of naughtiness. Do you wonder what that is? Superfluity of naughtiness, and receive with meekness the engrafted word. Well, the word naughtiness is wickedness, it's very strong, and the Revised Standard Version puts it, and laying aside the rank growth of wickedness, much stronger than our English version sounds today. Do you see that? Rank growth of wickedness. Or go back to the Old Testament, to Jeremiah, chapter 24, where we have rather an extraordinary occurrence of this word. As a matter of fact, it sounds quite amusing to our ears today. Jeremiah 24. The Lord gives Jeremiah a vision of two baskets of figs. Verse 1. Verse 2. One basket had very good figs, even like figs that are first ripe. The other basket had very naughty figs. But what's a naughty fig? Very naughty figs, which could not be eaten. They were so bad. Well, you see, you can't impute moral qualities to fruit, can you? You can't say they're wicked or naughty. But you see, take its literal meaning. They were worth naught. They weren't worth anything. They'd gone bad, as we say. They couldn't be eaten. So there's the meaning, you see. They were bad figs in the sense that they were rotten and couldn't be eaten. And God says these two figs are like the two parts of the children of Israel. Some had been taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, Ezekiel amongst them. They were the good figs. They represented the good figs. Those that had been left in the land, just a few of them left back, under Zedekiah, or the last wicked king, God says, I liken them to naughty figs. Figs that are good for naught. Wicked. And you remember what happened to that king, King Zedekiah. Another old English word which you come across in the book of Job. Do you know what to knees means? N-E-E-S-E, or kneesing. Job chapter 41. This is the description, a wonderful chapter describing the whale. It's called the Leviathan, the largest mammal in the sea. Verse 18. By his kneesings a light doth shine, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. But what's a kneesing? Well, if I tell you what the Hebrew is, it's one of those words which sound like it means. And meaning and sense go together. The Hebrew is atisha, a sneeze. Just like that. Atisha, a sneeze. And that's what it says. You say, well, how did it become sneeze after being knees? Well, in Old English, it was spelled F-N S-E-S-E. And then you may remember, probably you've seen some old Victorian handwriting. You remember how they used to make double S? The first S was made like an F. You've seen that, haven't you? F, S. Well, you see what happened. In printing or in reading, someone took that F for an S and stuck an S on the front. So instead of S-N-E-S, it got F-N. And it's stuck ever since. To sneeze. And of course, there again, it's a word which sounds very much like the actual thing. So it just means sneezing. Now let's come to a word that is really much more important. That is the verb to occupy, which has completely changed its meaning. Let's look at Luke chapter 19. Luke 19. The parable of the pounds, verse 13. A certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return, verse 12, and he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and said to them, occupy till I come. Well, it doesn't mean to take any place, but to occupy or to take a position. It means to do business. That's what it means. It means to trade or to do business. And so the command was, do your business until I come. This is a practical word, of course, because, you know, often it's been recorded of some whose idea of being ready for the Lord's coming has been to drop all their business, give it all up, and to sit down and gaze up at the stars, or up at the clouds. Well, that's not being practical. No, the Lord says, you get on, do your business until I come. Occupy, to do business. Look at an Old Testament example of it. Ezekiel 37. Again, another wonderful chapter. I thought one of the most wonderful chapters in Ezekiel, this description of one of the greatest of maritime cities and traders, Tyre. The fabulous trade that Tyre had, that this chapter tells you about. You want to read it all the way through. It's a long chapter. Read it too in a modern version because that will help you to understand it better. But in this chapter 27 and the 9th verse, this is what we read. The inhabitants of Zidon and Arvad were thy mariners. The wise men, O Tarus, were in thee, were thy pilots. The ancients of Gebel and the wise men thereof were in thee thy caulkers, and we've still got it, that extraordinary word today. You go up to Scotland, go up to the places where ships are built, they've still got their caulkers, friends. Look at the margin, a stopper up of holes. That's it. A stopper of holes, so the sea doesn't get in. All the ships of the sea, with their mariners, were in thee to occupy thy merchandise. To occupy thy merchandise. Well, the occupy means to trade. And so, you have to translate it in modern English, to barter for your wares. There was bartering going on, change. There wasn't so much money in those days, but they exchanged. A very good thing too, I always feel. What a great pity. The old-fashioned way of bartering ever stopped. I know it would make things very cumbersome, friends. But believe me, you'd have real value, wouldn't you, every time. And real work to exchange. And when man dropped that, he started some of his problems, some of his commercial problems. Barter for your wares would be a modern rendering of it. Now let's look at this word offend. Offend. We talk about offending anybody, getting on the wrong side of them, causing them hurt. You see, that's not the meaning. Let's go to the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5, verses 29 and 30. If thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out. But in what sense can your right eye, in the modern usage of the word, offend you? Can you be offended by any member of your own body?
You can be perhaps distressed if that member doesn't behave itself properly or function properly. It wouldn't offend you, would it? It might pain you, yes. But the word means literally to place something in another's way to cause them to stumble or to sin. That's a very different thing, isn't it? Now, if your right eye causes you to sin, if what you're looking at causes you to sin, stop it, says the Saviour. You see? Just making it perfectly clear by using that figure. Or, if you come to the 13th chapter of Matthew, we get another example. Matthew chapter 13. Verse 41. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend. All things that offend. All things that sin. This is a gathering out of sin. He's going to remove all causes of sin. That's the meaning of it in modern language. All causes of sin. Or in the 18th chapter of Matthew, it occurs several times in this first gospel. Verse 6. But whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it was better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. What an awful thing to say. But if you just offend a little one, if you cause a little one to sin, much stronger, do you see? If you cause one of these little ones to sin, then it's far better that a millstone were tied to the neck and the person was drowned. Or, I don't think you need to turn to it, 1 Corinthians 8, causing a brother to offend, causing a brother to stumble or sin. You can put stumbling or sin in every occurrence of this word to offend, having a deeper meaning in the 17th century to what it has today. The next word I want to see is another word that's completely changed its meaning much more. The word passenger. Now, we only talk of passengers today who are being carried in a vehicle. Travellers in a vehicle. Never used like that in the Bible. Ever. Proverbs chapter 9. Proverbs chapter 9. And verse 15. This is the foolish woman, verse 13. She's clamorous, she's simple, she knows nothing, and so on. For she sits at the door of her house, on a seat in the high places of the city, to call passengers who go right on their ways. To call passengers. Well, she's not watching for people being taken along in a cart or something. Not passengers. The word just means a traveller, a passerby. A walker. Someone that's walking by. She's calling travellers and trying to entice them into her place. Not one who's carried at all. Or let's turn to another one. This time a far more difficult one in Ezekiel chapter 39. In the prophecy concerning Gog and the judgment on Gog at the end time. Verse 11. This is an extraordinary chapter that's dealing with the after effects of God's terrific judgment on Gog. The burying of the corpses, the number of slain in the battle, the getting rid of the armaments, the long time this is going to take. In that day. Verse 11. It shall come to pass in that day that I will give unto Gog a place there of the graves in Israel, the valley of the passengers on the east of the sea. And it shall stop the noses of the passengers. And there they shall bury Gog. Well, what does that mean? Stop the noses. Will you note that the word noses is in italics? It's not in the Hebrew at all. And they simply supplied the word because they couldn't understand what to make of it. You see?
This isn't the idea of people holding their noses because there was a big smell. That's what it sounds like. This word passenger, of course, is just passers-by, it's travellers. And the word stop is to block. It's going to block the way of the travellers. In other words, all this is going to stop up the roads, so the travellers can't travel along them. That's what it means. Nothing to do with holding their noses or anyone being carried along in any vehicles. Those who travel along will be blocked, is the meaning of the word, and it's so correctly translated by the Revised Standard Version. Now, another word. This time, it applies even to us, because it occurs in Titus, it occurs in Deuteronomy, and it occurs in 1 Peter. The word peculiar. The Lord has purified to himself a peculiar people. Now, of course, there are a good many people who would agree with that. When they look at some Christians, they say, yes, they are a peculiar lot. Well, there again, of course, we're using the word peculiar in the modern sense, and it's not used like that in the Bible at all. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 14. Deuteronomy 14 and the second verse. You are the children of the Lord your God, it starts off. Now verse 2. For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God, and the Lord hath chosen thee to be a peculiar people to himself. Not funny, not odd, but it means to be specially belonging to somebody. Peculiar, one's very own, one's personal private property. That was the meaning of the word, peculiar, in the 17th century. So they're going to be God's special property. Lovely thought, isn't it? And that's what said of the body of Christ in Titus, this is quoted. A peculiar people, zealous of good works. Specially precious to the Lord. In fact, you see, this is true of all his people. This isn't something that we can say is true only in the body of Christ. This is said of the people of Israel, and it occurs again in Malachi. When I make up my jewels, my special treasure. Lovely word, isn't it? That's God's earthly people, who are faithful to him. The faithful remnant of Israel, who in a day of apostasy, they just think on the Lord, and think on his name. Oh, God said, I'm watching that. I'm making a note of that. I'm marking that in my book. They shall be mine, saith Jehovah, in the day that I make up my jewels. Lovely thought. My own special treasure. My own peculiar property belonging specially to me. Isn't it lovely to be claimed by God like that? We are his own special property. That's the meaning of it. Not odd, not peculiar, not funny in that sense. The phrase point out is changed today. We point out something. We indicate either in talking or in action by using a finger pointing out something. That is not the way it's used in our English version. Numbers, we're in the Old Testament, so we'll go back one book to Numbers chapter 34. And this is the apportioning out of the land in Canaan when Israel got to Canaan. And you will read in verse 7, God says, this shall be your north border. From the great sea, you shall point out for you Mount Hor. I didn't mean to say you'll just stand there and point it out. Look at it or point it out. And the next verse, from Mount Hor, you shall point out your border unto the entrance of Hamath. It means, of course, our modern mark out. This was marking the limits or the lines of the inheritance. Point out in the 17th century meant to mark out. I was going to say something about the word porter, but I don't think there's any need to. Of course, originally, it didn't mean a carrier, although it got that meaning. But it really meant a gatekeeper. Did you know that? And so you read in 1 Chronicles, you need to look it up, of the temple which had its porters. Well, they weren't people carrying things, they were looking after the entrances.
to the temple. And it comes very near in the French port, you see, in just the same way, a gate or an opening. So a porter in the Bible is a gatekeeper. Now another word, I want you to turn to Judges chapter 5. Just two more in this study. The book of Judges and the fifth chapter in the Song of Deborah. She talks there about the prancing of the horses. Well, you say there's nothing extraordinary about that, because we still talk about horses prancing. Yes, but not as the Authorized Version translators meant it. When a horse is restive and puts its feet up and down, we talk about him prancing. But the Authorized Version translators didn't mean that. It meant to gallop, to go along very quickly in our old English. So in Judges 5 and verse 22, it says, "Then were the horse hoofs broken by the means of the prancings of the mighty ones." Does it sound strange, doesn't it? What does it mean? Well, let me translate it into modern English. The Revised Standard Version puts it this way: "Then loud beat the horse's hooves with the galloping of his steeds." That sounds better. The galloping, you see, the prancing was not so many going up and down, the galloping of their steeds. And if I could turn you to one of the least known of the minor prophets, the book of Nahum. And do I insult you if I say you'll have a job to find it? I don't know how often you read the minor prophets. But if you turn to the book of Nahum that comes just before Habakkuk, and look at chapter 3. This is also a most graphic chapter describing the fall of the great city of Nineveh, which was one of the greatest of all the cities of ancient time, the capital of Assyria. It starts off, "Woe to the bloody city," the city of murder, the city of bloods, literally. "It's all full of lies and robbery. The prey departeth not. The noise of the whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheels, and the prancing horses, and of the jumping chariots." Well, I don't know how chariots jump. Chariots don't usually jump, do they? Again, let me give you a modern translation. The crack of the whip, the rumble of the wheels, the galloping horses, the bounding chariots. See what a graphic picture. Read it all through like that. Read it in a modern version, Weymouth, or the Revised Standard Version. You'll see how these men of God, under the inspiration of the Spirit, could draw such marvellous pictures. This is wonderful literature, friends, of course, but it's wonderful truth as well. And why can't God present truth in a way that's really thrilling to read? Why it isn't so thrilling is often because this English is old and we don't grip. It's too archaic for us. Now, just one more, and that is the change in the word presently, where we talk about a thing being done presently a little later on, but not straight away. I'll do something presently. I'll do it a little later on. Whereas, in the Bible times, it meant I'll do it straight away, without any waiting whatsoever. Matthew 21. Matthew 21. The judgment of the Lord upon the fig tree. This has worried and puzzled quite a number of Bible students. "And when he saw a fig tree in the way, he came to it, and found nothing thereon, but leaves only, and said to it, 'Let no fruit grow on thee henceforward forever.' And presently, the fig tree withered away." A little later on, it withered away. Not so. Immediately, it withered away. Straight away, far more dramatic, you see. Immediately, it withered away. Or, turn to the 26th chapter. And this is a very important context too, which we shall miss unless we know the meaning of this word, or as it was used.
in the time the Authorized Version was translated, chapter 26 and verse 52. Then said Jesus to him, put up again thy sword into its place. For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? Give me presently. No, give me straight away. Don't you think I can pray? And immediately he'll answer my prayer. Immediately. Give me 12 legions of angels. Legions of angels. So it's very important to alter that, friends. Presently, always, in the Bible, meant straight away and not later on. Well, that'll be the last word we're going to study today. And we may just take this into two more times. And I hope, as I've said before, once or twice, that some of these contexts you'll feel has been really worthwhile trying to get the modern equivalent. That is why I've said, and I'll say it again, to repeat this, that with our Authorized Version, but not substituting, never lay this most marvellous translation down as though it's completely obsolete and should never be used, but read it side by side with a modern translation. And then a lot of these things will be straightened out for you.